on 98 FM and online. This is Phoenix FM.
Good evening. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And I hope once again you're having a very happy and healthy week. And I'm here to hopefully make it even happier and healthier. Yes, we will be talking a little bit about the virus, which is still persistently there in the background, isn't it? I'm thinking that life is returning to some semblance of normality, but we're not out of the woods yet, are we? So we still need to be taking care. So we'll be talking a little bit about the virus during the show, but also we'll be thinking about other things that you can do to keep yourself in tip-top health too. So starting off with our usual news roundup and then talking about the obesity problem. That's certainly been in the news a lot and certainly been associated with the virus as well. Or if you're obese, you're more likely to be susceptible to the virus, certainly, it does seem. So, so we'll be talking a little bit about that. But first of all, our news roundup. Now, what's your positivity, or what's your level of positivity like? If your cup is always half empty, you might want to start seeing it as half full, because people who regularly have high negative and depressive thoughts are more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease in older age. Researchers can even see the physical consequences of repetitive negative thinking, as they, or RNT as they call it, with half empty thinkers developing more of the harmful proteins in the brain that are linked to Alzheimer's. So if that's you, start meditating or doing mindfulness practices, becoming aware of your thoughts and surroundings, say researchers from University College London, is very good for you. Negative thinking is an underlying reason why some people suffer from dementia or Alzheimer's. But it has to be a long-term chronic view of the world. The occasional setback when we occasionally have negative thoughts and feelings won't cause any lasting damage to our cognitive abilities. The researchers tracked the mental health of just under 300 people over the age of 55 for 2 years. And the way they ruminated about the past and worried about the future was an important measure of their RNT score. And those with high RNT scores suffered greater cognitive decline over a 4-year period, including greater memory loss. And brain scans also revealed they had higher deposits of tau and amyloid proteins, which are seen in dementia and Alzheimer's patients. RNT is a new risk factor, the researchers say, and so it's important that people who regularly have negative thoughts should counteract them by taking up meditation or mindfulness. Excellent. I would thoroughly recommend that. And every drug is susceptible to the placebo effect, where the person feels better even when there's no active ingredient, and that goes for psychedelics too. People given a placebo instead of a psilocybin, the active ingredient in magic mushrooms, still had a trip. 20 of the 33 participants given the placebo said they experienced some psychedelic experience, such as seeing paintings on the wall move or reshape themselves. Researchers from McGill University invited the participants to a psychedelic party, which included lights and music, and there were 10 white-coated assistants in the room to help anyone who had a bad trip. Now, the researchers said context and setting were everything, and it convinced most of the participants that they were taking magic mushrooms and not a sugar pill. But there is a serious side to the research. With psychedelics being used to treat depression, it's possible for patients to be given a harmless placebo, which wouldn't have all the side effects of a psychedelic, and still get similar benefits. Amazing, isn't it? Where do all these pieces of research take place? I'm sure the students must be researching them, and I guess they have a jolly good time doing that too. And toxic chemicals in pesticides, cookware and fire retardants could be a cause of celiac disease, the immune disorder that can trigger a fatal reaction to gluten. Young people with high levels of DDE, a chemical found in pesticides in their blood, were twice as likely to develop the disease, and the association is even more marked in young girls, who were up to 9 times more likely to have the problem if they had high levels of another chemical, PFAS, found in non-stick cookware in their blood. Researchers at New York University School of Medicine say there is also a strong possibility the chemicals can cause autoimmune bowel disease. It's been thought that celiac disease and other immune disorders are genetic, but the research team say there is very strong evidence they can also be environmental. They tested the blood of 30 children and young adults who had celiac disease ranging in age from 3 to 21 years old for levels of toxic chemicals and compared the results with samples taken from 60 healthy young people. So it's surprising. Chemicals are hidden in everything, aren't they? We do need to look out and watch out for these things. And standard hair dyes can be hard on your hair and increase your cancer risk. Using a dye that includes melanin can produce the same results without the health risks, say researchers at Northwestern University. Melanin is a natural pigment that gives our hair its colour, but it starts to disappear from hair fibres as we age. To restore colour, permanent hair dyes use ammonia and hydrogen peroxide to penetrate the cuticles in our hair. But the process isn't kind to our hair. It can trigger allergic reactions and could even cause cancer. Even popular products that use synthetic melanin often contain high levels of heavy metals such as copper and iron, which can also be toxic. The Northwestern researchers wanted to discover a gentler and safer way to colour hair with synthetic melanin and found it by using mild heat and substituting the heavy metals with ammonium hydroxide. Darker colours were achieved by increasing the amount of ammonium hydroxide and a small amount of hydrogen peroxide gave hair red or gold shades. The results were the same and as long-lasting as those from professional dyes and salons and lasted for 18 washes, the researchers said. Well, that's good, isn't it? I'm all for things being more natural. And eating extra protein could help women regulate their periods. Just eating an extra 300 to 400 calories every day could be all it takes to re-establish a regular menstrual cycle, say researchers. And that could be especially the case for women who do intense exercise. Women who don't eat enough to support their exercise regime can trigger a medical condition known as female athlete triad, which includes menstrual disorders and poor bone health. That's according to researchers from Penn State University. Women with the problem are more likely to suffer fractures. And in a year-long study involving 62 young women who exercised regularly and suffered from irregular menstrual cycles, half increased the number of calories they ate, while the rest maintained their existing diets. The women who ate the extra calories were twice as likely to see their menstrual cycle normalise during the 12 months. Our researchers said just eating a little more each day could be all it takes to remedy menstrual disorders without needing to take powerful prescription medication with its potential for serious side effects. And rising carbon dioxide levels aren't only contributing to global warming, they're also affecting our ability to think. It reduces the amount of oxygen getting to our brain, affecting our ability to think and understand. It also makes us sleepier and more anxious. As it's in the air we breathe, it can affect everyone from school children to a business executive. That's according to researchers at the University of Colorado Boulder. And it's more concentrated in indoor spaces such as classrooms and homes. Our ability to make decisions and plan is especially affected by carbon dioxide in our blood, the researchers say, and at very high levels can reduce our decision-making capacities by 25% and complex strategic thinking by up to 50%. So I think that's a good reason probably to do some breathing exercises and make sure we're getting enough oxygen into our lungs. And women who are given good bacteria when they're pregnant may be less likely to have an autistic child. The bacteria lower inflammation, which can help the brain and central nervous system of the fetus develop healthily. It's especially effective if the woman takes the bacteria during the third trimester if she's stressed. That's according to researchers again at the University of Colorado Boulder. Earlier research has shown that stress triggers inflammation and this in turn affects the fetus and increases the risk of autism and autism-like symptoms such as behavioural problems and repetitive patterns. Some also develop epilepsy-like seizures and in experiments with laboratory rats, the researchers made some of the pregnant rats stressed before giving them a friendly bacteria, which has anti-inflammatory effects. The pups born to the mothers given the bacterium didn't have autism-like behaviours. Aside from probiotics, women can get friendly bacteria from fermented foods such as yogurt and sauerkraut. While the researchers accept they are still a long way off from eradicating autism, they believe they have discovered one vital key that can reduce the number of cases. For their part, women need to recognise symptoms of stress and anxiety, and while the cause can often be emotional, it can also be the result of environmental pollutants. Now, this is the first maternal intervention that has been done, and that's been able to prevent an autism-like syndrome, including the behavioural and social aspects. If this could be replicated in humans, that could be very profound indeed. So watch this space. I shall let you know more if any more is reported on or researched. Right, we're going to have a little break now, and after the break I'll be returning to you to talk about the current obesity problem and the reasons why we should be thinking about losing weight if we are indeed overweight. Stay tuned for more after this.
We ride, carry us over horizon. Sun as the sun setting night, put on a phantom cloak, sing violet light and evoke the protection that violet evokes. Fasten your fur, cuss on your soul, causes your fruit and flowers on. Red reaper on, swift justice comes, delivery white. Fixing the sea, a pair of gold shiny, and if I can pull it free, the cudgel is coming with me. Fasten heave ho, pillar of gold runs through the deepest, darkest stone. Cudgel and dun, weigh one ton, bring on your force, white bone demon.
Radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. Yes, obesity, there's been a lot of that in the press, and Boris is trying to encourage everybody to lose weight. So, I mean, men who store fat around their midriff are in greater danger of dying from prostate cancer as well, research suggests. So it's not just COVID that we may be having to worry about, but also other things as well that could be triggered by putting on a little bit too much weight. So a man with a 40-inch, which is 103 centimetres waist or above, has a 35% higher risk of dying from prostate cancer than somebody who has a 35-inch or lower trouser size. Now, it was an Oxford University study, and they looked at over 200,000 men, and they did not find an increased risk in people with higher overall body fat if it was spread around the body. Now, this suggests it's the specific location of the fat that makes males more prone to this killer disease. Fat stored in the belly is considered the most dangerous type because it coats vital organs such as the liver, pancreas, and intestines. This may interfere with their normal function and promote the growth of cancerous cells, the researchers say. Now, the latest research presented at the European and International Conference on Obesity looked at just over 200,000 cancer-free men in the UK whose medical data is stored in the UK Biobank. As scientists monitored them for 10 years, looking at their BMI, total body fat percentage, waist circumference and waist-to-hip ratio. Men in the top 25% for waist circumference, they found, were 35% more likely to die of prostate cancer than men in the bottom 25%. The largest group included those whose waist measured more than 40 inches, and the waist does not include the hip bones, but it's a soft section between the pelvis and the ribs, level with the belly button. Now, men in the smallest group were those who had waist smaller than 35 inches. Meanwhile, those in the top quarter for waist-to-hip ratio, another measurement of how much fat is located around the belly area, were 34% more likely to die than men in the bottom quarter. The risk remained the same even when medical history and lifestyle factors were factored in. However, researchers didn't discover any clear association between a man's BMI or total fat percentage and prostate cancer. This means that even a man who was fatter or heavier overall may not be at the same level of increased risk if most of their fat was stored in their legs and arms. It suggests those who specifically store most of their fat around their midriff were more prone to dying from the disease. Now, they found a significant association between concentration of body fat around the belly and waist and the risk of prostate cancer death, but no clear association between total body fat and risk of prostate cancer death. However, a large number of cases in this study, together with studies in other populations, are needed to confirm these findings. A high BMI increases the risk of other diseases, including other types of cancer, so people should consider the implications of excess body fat wherever it's found in the body. Previous studies have indicated that visceral fat, which is stored in the belly, is the most dangerous type. Excess visceral fat appears to boost numbers of a protein called fibroblast, the fibroblast growth factor 2, which stimulates the growth of tumour cells. But research into visceral fat is still in its early stages, though. Now, this is the most dangerous fat because this fat is located around the vital organs, is associated with metabolic and hormonal dysfunction, and this is what may play a role in prostate cancer progression. Now, the message to men is to exercise and eat a healthy diet to ensure you maintain a healthy weight and lower waist circumference. Prostate cancer has become the most commonly diagnosed form of the disease in the UK, and a total, roughly 57,000 men in England, Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales were told they had it in 2018, which is a substantial nearly 50,000 rise from the previous year and up from around 24,000 again in 1998. Now, it means diagnosis of prostate cancer has more than doubled in the past 20 years and has now overtaken breast cancer as the most common form. Experts attribute the increase to rising numbers of men getting tested, as well as the growing and ageing population. High-profile cases such as TV presenter Bill Turnbull and actor Stephen Fry going public with their prostate cancer have also shone a light on this once taboo subject. So prostate cancer became a bigger killer than breast cancer for the first time, official statistics revealed last year. More than 11,800 men a year, or one every 45 minutes, are now killed by the disease in Britain, compared with about 11,400 women dying of breast cancer. But that's kind of equal in my book, I think. Prostate cancer usually develops slowly, so there may be no signs that someone has found it for many years, according to the NHS. And if the cancer is at an early stage and not causing symptoms, a policy of watchful waiting or active surveillance may be adopted. Some patients can be cured if the disease is treated in the early stages, but if it's diagnosed at a later stage when it has spread, then it becomes terminal and treatment revolves around relieving symptoms. Tests for prostate cancer are haphazard, with accurate tools only just beginning to emerge. There is no national prostate screening program, as for years the tests have been too inaccurate. Doctors struggle to distinguish between aggressive and less serious tumours, making it hard to decide on treatment. Men over 50 are eligible for a PSA blood test, which gives doctors a rough idea of whether a patient is at risk. But it is unreliable. Patients who get a positive result are usually given a biopsy, which is also not foolproof. Scientists are unsure as to what causes prostate cancer, but age, obesity and a lack of exercise are known risks. So if you do have any concerns, then you can call the Prostate Cancer UK Specialist Nurses, and you can find those online as well. So it really is so important to be vigilant in cases like this, because if you catch it early, it's so much more easy to deal with. It really is. And obesity isn't just a problem in the ageing population, it's also a problem for younger people as well. Children who get little sleep and spend too much time on their phones or tablets are more likely to be obese, research suggests. For every extra hour of screen use, youngsters are 16% more likely to become overweight or obese, while every hour less of sleep drove up the risk by 23%, according to a study of more than 4,000 children. The Royal College of Surgeons, which conducted the research, found there was a direct correlation between increased screen use and decreased sleep time. And it said that cutting down on the amount of time youngsters spend on electronics could help them sleep longer and eat better. Sleep deprivation causes changes to hormones that regulate hunger and appetite, which make people more prone to overeating. A lack of energy also makes people less likely to exercise and burn off whatever food they do consume. And using screens at night sends signals to the body that makes it difficult to know it's nighttime and get sleepy. Pre-teenage children need upwards of 10 hours per night of sleep to help their growing brains and bodies develop properly. The latest research, presented at the European and International Conference on Obesity, followed just over 4,000 children in 8 different countries in Europe between 2010 and 2014, and participants were aged 2 to 11. And parents reported on how much time their children spent on average watching TV, playing games consoles, using a mobile phone, computer or tablet, and sleeping each day. And the researchers found that screen time and sleep duration had an inverse correlation, meaning a decrease in one caused an increase in the other. It showed children who used screens more slept less. For every extra hour spent on gadgets, there was a 16% increased chance of obesity, and the risk was 23% for every hour of sleep lost. But because one often accompanied the other, the true risk could be much higher for children. Now, researchers from the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland said sleep is an often undervalued but important part of children's development, with a regular lack of sleep causing a variety of health problems. The findings suggest that sleep duration plays a role in the link between screen time and overweight, but more research is needed to understand the mechanism underlying this relationship. And the authors acknowledge that their study was an observational one, so no conclusions about cause and effect can be drawn. They point to several limitations, including that the study didn't examine potentially confounding factors such as physical activity, family history of obesity, or eating habits. They also accept parents may have misreported sleep duration and screen time. However, the study follows a wealth of research with similar findings. And a review of 80 studies on more than 200,000 people in 2018 ranked smartphones and tablets alongside sugary drinks as one of the biggest risks for childhood obesity. And research done by the World Cancer Research Fund examined the causes of weight gain in children around the world, and it found increasing amounts of time spent on smartphones, tablets and gaming is a big driver of children getting fatter. That and sugary drinks make up the top two. So it means that children are doing less exercise. Sitting inside looking at screens makes youngsters more likely to overeat on snacks as well. So it's passive overconsumption. So, you know, if you want to keep your children healthy, maybe encourage them to spend a little less time on screen and developing healthier eating patterns. It's all about educating, really, isn't it? We'll have a little break now, and after the break we'll talk on the obesity problem, so and more facts and figures on that. So stay tuned for more after this.
Shit.
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And we're talking about obesity tonight. Yes, obesity has been linked to suffering the virus more seriously than people who perhaps are more slender and who exercise more. So there are other problems as well associated with obesity as well. What can we do about it? And people who eat most of their calories after 6 p.m. tend to have unhealthier diets and eat more overall, according to a study. Researchers said that late eaters were more likely to gain weight because they tend to let themselves get extremely hungry during the day. And this makes them more prone to binge eating, making bad food choices and eating junk food in the evening. Whereas those who consume their biggest meals earlier in the day are often too full to stuff their faces at night. So in this latest study, researchers from Ulster University in Northern Ireland looked at more than 1,100 adults as part of the UK National Diet and Nutrition Survey. Now, this nationwide survey began in 2008 and it collects detailed information on the food consumption, nutrient intake and nutritional status. Volunteers aged 19 to 64 were quizzed about their meal timings and food choices, and the researchers found those who ate 30% or less of their food at night consumed less total calories overall than any group, whereas those who ate half of their calories at night were more likely to gain weight and consume food with little nutrition. Diet quality was assessed by scoring the food diaries kept by the participants using the Nutrient Rich Food Index, which classifies and ranks foods according to the ratio of important nutrients they contain relative to their energy content. Now, the researchers said the results suggest that consuming a lower proportion of calories in the evening may be associated with a lower daily energy intake, while consuming a greater proportion of energy intake in the evening may be associated with a lower diet quality score. Timing of energy intake may be an important modifier behaviour to consider in future nutritional interventions. Further analysis is now needed to examine whether the distribution of energy intake or the types of food consumed in the evening are associated with measures of body composition and cardiometabolic health. The findings are due to be presented at the European and International Conference on Obesity, and it comes after a study found that people who skipped breakfast were more likely to have a high BMI. Scientists found people who ate 3.5 hours later on weekends had BMIs 1.3 units higher compared to those who stuck to their routine. And this remained true despite the quality of their diet, how long they slept for, or how much they exercised. Now, the University of Barcelona researchers behind the study said that our biological clocks, called circadian systems, prepare the metabolism to break down food at specific times. Cells are programmed in this way so they know when to spend energy taking up or utilizing specific nutrients. The metabolism becomes sluggish at breaking down food when it's caught off guard by eating at different times, and this seems to lead to the storage of extra fat. The researchers surveyed more than 1,100 students from Spain and Mexico to come to this conclusion, and they asked participants what time they normally ate breakfast, lunch and dinner on weekdays and weekends. Almost two-thirds ate meals an hour later on their days off, and breakfast was the most delayed meal, tending to become brunch. The study found the greater the time difference between weekday and weekend meals, the more likely students were to be overweight. Eating 3.5 hours later on weekends seemed to cause the most extreme weight gain, the equivalent of having brunch on a Saturday at 11:30 a.m. compared to breakfast on a Friday at 8 a.m. People who ate this late on the weekend had a BMI 1.3 units higher than participants who ate at roughly the same time on weekdays and weekends. Dropping 1.3 BMI units is equivalent to someone who is 170 centimetres tall and weighs 14 stone, losing half a stone, or 7 pounds. So there's quite a significant weight loss there that can be achieved just by regulating the time you eat. So eating dinner late at night can lead to high blood sugar levels and put people at increased risk of being overweight. Scientists found that eating shortly before going to bed makes the body less able to process all the nutrients and glucose, and as a result, people burn 10% less fat overnight if they eat at 10 p.m. compared to having their evening meal at 6 p.m. Researchers studied 20 healthy volunteers, 10 men and 10 women, to see how dinner time affected their overnight digestion. The volunteers all went to bed at 11 p.m. and their body's metabolism was assessed throughout the day as they slept in a special laboratory bedroom. Activity trackers provided data on the individuals, while blood sampling was done every hour throughout the night. Body fat scans were also performed, and the participants were only fed food with specific labels that allowed scientists to track the rate of fat burning. All the data was crunched and published in the Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. The study found that blood sugar levels were higher and the amount of ingested fat burned was lower if a person ate dinner just 1 hour before bed. Now, on average, the peak glucose level after late dinner was about 18% higher, and the amount of fat burned overnight decreased by about 10% compared to eating an earlier dinner. Well, I think the evidence there is clear, isn't it? We need to eat earlier, not later. And another piece of news in the weight loss related categories, that thousands of people with type 2 diabetes are being enrolled into an NHS trial of soups and shakes diets, which has been proven to reverse the illness. A total of 5,000 patients in England have been signed up to trial the radical 12-month diet programme to slim them down and restore their health. Volunteers will be restricted to just 800 calories per day, a third of an adult man's recommended daily intake and almost half of a woman's. Their meals will be limited to blended shakes, bowls of soup and health bars for 3 months before real nutritious food is reintroduced for the remaining 9 months. Type 2 diabetes is linked in most cases to being overweight or obese, not doing enough exercise and consuming too much sugar. The move is an expansion of a smaller trial after a 2018 study by Oxford University showed almost half of people who stuck to the soups and shakes plan saw their diabetes go into remission after a year. A diabetes is estimated to cost the health service £10 billion a year, while almost 1 in 20 prescriptions written by GPs are for diabetes treatment. The condition is also one of the biggest risk factors in coronavirus deaths, with around a third of UK COVID victims also suffering from the condition. A trial of the soups and shakes diet found it suitable for most people who want to lose weight, and it's effective because people consume fewer calories than they burn. The 5,000 volunteers who have all been diagnosed with diabetes in the last 6 years will start the programmes, or have already started the programmes. They will be told to swap out food for blended meal replacement shakes and soups for 3 months, and for the rest of the year they'll be coached by nutritionists who will help reintroduce ordinary nutritious meals into their diets and increase their exercise levels. Now, this is the latest example of how the NHS, through their long-term plan, is rapidly adopting the latest evidence-based treatments to help people stay well, maintain a healthy weight, and avoid major diseases. There's never been a more important time to lose weight and put their type 2 diabetes into remission, so it's good news for thousands of people across the country that practical supportive measures like this are increasingly available on the NHS. It's an important first step for patients to access a remission programme within the NHS. And some people with type 2 diabetes want and need support from healthcare professionals to lose weight effectively. And now, as these programmes are piloted across the NHS, they'll have that. People with type 2 diabetes who have put their diabetes into remission frequently tell of how it has changed their lives. And it's great to see that others can also change their lives as well, have that same opportunity. And hopefully it won't be too long before more remission programmes are rolled out across the country. A type 2 diabetes is the most common form of the disease, affecting 90% of all 4.7 million diabetics in the UK. Type 1 diabetes is caused when the pancreas doesn't produce enough insulin to regulate the body's blood sugar levels and is generally caused by genetics, whereas type 2 is linked to obesity and eating too much sugar, which causes the body to become resistant to insulin. And because type 2 is mostly caused by people's lifestyles, it can be reversed through low-calorie and low-sugar diets. And the trial comes just about a month after Boris Johnson's government launched a drive to tackle obesity, after the Prime Minister realised his own weight may have contributed to him ending up in intensive care when he caught the virus. He said that since his recovery from the deadly illness, he'd focused on getting fitter by going on morning runs with his dog Dylan, and he's urged the nation to follow his lead, insisting the government's better health strategy will help people to bring their weight down and better protect the NHS. And the UK is the second fattest country in Europe, with 2/3 of adults above a healthy weight, according to government data, and 1 in 3 children aged 10 to 11 are overweight or obese. Now, the government's new anti-obesity strategy will attempt to bring an end to confectionery displays at shop checkouts and a ban on adverts for foods high in fat, sugar and salt on TV before 9 p.m. And deals such as buy one, get one free on unhealthy foods will also be banned, while alcoholic drinks could soon have to list their calorie content too. Placing sugary and fatty items in prominent locations in stores will be stopped, including at checkouts and entrances and online. And instead, they're going to be encouraged to promote healthier choices and offer more discounts on healthy foods such as fruit and vegetables. Well, that sounds like a jolly good idea, doesn't it? So it's all good stuff, isn't it? So we're going to take another little break now. And after the break, we'll be talking more about the obesity crisis and how to lose weight as well, and the benefits that it brings too. Must focus on those benefits. So important. Okay, let's take a little break. Be back with more right after this.
Come on.
community radio for Brentwood and Billericay. This is Phoenix FM.
Welcome back. You're listening to Body Talk here on Phoenix 98 FM with me, Mel Watson. And we're talking about obesity and the obesity crisis and the problems that are involved with obesity. It's not just the virus that we need to worry about. But there are all sorts of other potentially hazardous illnesses that we can get as a result of being obese. So what can we do? Well, there is an electrical device that stimulates nerve endings behind the ears that could be a pioneering new treatment for those who struggle to lose weight. The device is worn as a headset and it sends electrical signals to the vestibular nerves, which are linked to the parts of the brain that control fat storage and hunger. The idea is that this will help people feel fuller with less food intake, and some 200 people are taking part in clinical trials of the headset. Now, one in four Britons is classed as obese, with nearly two-thirds of adults overweight, and dieting can be effective for some, but many quickly put the weight back on. And in one study, although dieters lost up to 10% of their starting weight in the first 6 months of a new regime, two-thirds had regained more weight than they had lost within 5 years. That's according to the University of California scientists who wrote in the journal American Psychologist. And the new headset consists of two electrodes attached to patches that are placed on the skin behind each ear, where the vestibular nerve endings sit. When activated, the electrodes emit low-level pulses of electrical stimulation, which may trigger a light tingling sensation behind the ears. The vestibular nerve is involved in balance control, but is also linked to the hypothalamus, a region of the brain that deals with regulating appetite and food intake, as well as metabolic rate and fat storage. Researchers believe that appetite and metabolism regulation by the hypothalamus can vary widely between individuals, which is why some people gain weight more easily than others. It's thought daily pulse stimulation of the vestibular nerve could trigger the hypothalamus into reducing cravings and appetite by stimulating the production of hormones such as leptin and insulin. Previous research has found that leptin tells the brain when the body has stored enough fat, which in turn curbs appetite, while insulin regulates the absorption of blood sugar by cells and is linked to weight gain. Half of the 200 people taking part in the trials led by the University College Dublin will receive stimulation treatment, while the rest will have a dummy or placebo therapy for 45 minutes a day for 3 months. At first glance, it might seem a scatterbrained idea, but there is evidence to back up the research. If the trials confirm the anticipated benefits, specialist clinicians will find it invaluable for many patients. Well, that sounds like an absolute godsend, doesn't it? I think that would be popular with everybody, wouldn't it, who's struggling to lose weight. I'd certainly be willing to give those a go, wearing some headphones. Maybe they play music as well. That would make it even better, wouldn't it? So what should we doing if we be doing if we want to be dieting? Now, we don't have a strong food culture in this country. We don't have our grandmothers teaching us what we should be eating like they do in the rest of Europe. We eat more ultra-processed food than any other country in Europe. And junk food and snacking is something that's now become part of our culture. And quite possibly large food companies are to blame for distorting research surrounding the food we should be eating, as well as the UK government's lack of funding for research. Now, food companies have got very big and strong as well, and most of us are becoming habitual eaters of junk food. And so what should we be doing? Well, should we be eating breakfast? I mean, there are fors and against for breakfast, really. Some say it is the most important meal of the day, but is it? For many people, it actually makes them put on weight. And so there's about half the population who will probably do very well by skipping breakfast. Is it the most important meal of the day? I think that is still one of the big unanswered questions, really. Restricted time eating is probably better. It can be done every day or even just once a week. It's a good idea to not eat for 14 hours so that your gut and your gut microbes can have a rest overnight. That means not eating all the time. And obviously this goes against what food companies are actually impressing on us to do. But scientific evidence is showing we could be compressing our eating times, and so starting later and finishing earlier. And while labels on food displaying calorie counts that are only accurate to within 20% and restaurants displaying menus with calorie counts for meals that can actually total 50% more or fewer calories than stated, it's no wonder that calorie counting doesn't always work. Now, I don't think any calorie-controlled diets have ever worked long-term because you really can't measure them accurately. Calories in doesn't equal calories out, and everything you eat depends on how you cook it, how it's prepared, and when you have it as well. So it doesn't really add up. And, well, we know if you starve, you don't have the calories, therefore you lose weight. But the idea that you can measure it accurately, that you can go and every day tick off calories, is perhaps not as accurate as we think it is. The reason it doesn't work is that they're very hard to measure and everyone has a different requirement. So the idea that women only have 2,000 calories is perhaps not as accurate as we think it is, because recent studies have shown that everybody is different. Everybody is unique in how many calories they need and so how many calories they burn as well. And so the idea of the guideline that fits everybody may not be exactly right. So, yes, chips are more calories and spinach are less calories, but basing your choice of food on calories rather than the quality and ingredients is basically not really that good, because we're obsessed with looking at labels about low calorie foods, low fat foods and low sugar. We should just forget looking at the calories and start eating properly. And if we do that and eat at the right times, then we could all be much healthier and lose weight. So, you know, if you look at sort of diets in other countries, you know, there is no such thing as a healthy snack. You should wait until meal times rather than grazing through the day. We were told about 20 years ago that eating a little and often was better for you, and it turns out that data was based on about 10 people 20 years ago. So it's not really as accurate as we may have been led to believe. And while most people believe that you must also expend calories through exercise to lose weight, not necessarily the case. Cardio exercise slows down your metabolism after the fact, meaning you're more likely to tip the balance with a biscuit. So exercise is good for you, obviously, and reduces your risk of many diseases. But what it doesn't do for 90% of people is make them lose weight, because it simply changes your metabolic rate so that it will slow down. So you might burn some calories exercising, but afterwards your body's reset. And your body's basically slowed down to such an extent that just having a biscuit with your tea will probably wipe out all that exercise. And most health advice seems to suggest the opposite, that exercise speeds up your metabolism and even helps burn fat when you're resting. It may not be exactly the case. So, you know, things that tell you how many calories you've burned and therefore you can go and have a donut may not be exactly right. We haven't really been able to measure how much people burn very well, because everybody burns calories at a different rate. So it's not that you won't lose weight exercising, but you shouldn't be using average figures, because it could just make it worse. The only way to lose weight is really to focus on the food and the diet and the timing of your food, and don't depend on exercise, although exercise is great for us, but that's not the kind of the be-all and end-all of dieting. But according to one study, couples who attempt to lose weight together are almost three times more likely to be successful. Heart attack survivors in the Netherlands were given lifestyle plans to aid recovery and cut their risk of suffering another. Partners were encouraged to join in so scientists could compare the success rates between couples who attempted to lose weight together and those who didn't. And survivors keen to drop the pounds lost more weight if they were supported by their spouse, results showed, and they were 2.7 times more likely to lose weight over a year than those who did it without the support of their partner, the researchers said. But partner participation did not influence the success rates of quitting smoking or exercising more, which the researchers suggested requires more personal motivation. The study showed that when spouses join the effort to change habits, people have a better chance of becoming healthier, particularly when it comes to losing weight. Now, a heart attack is when tissue dies because blood to the heart is blocked, most often due to a buildup of fat or cholesterol, and it's different from cardiac arrest when the heart's electrical system malfunctions. It's important for heart attack survivors to receive follow-up care so doctors can monitor their recovery and prevent another episode. It typically includes annual blood pressure checks, a blood test for cholesterol and kidney function, and a review of medication. The three main ways to prevent a heart attack are to eat healthier, to avoid hardening of the arteries, stopping smoking, and keeping blood pressure down, according to the NHS. And being active can lower your blood pressure by keeping the heart and blood vessels in good condition. If a person has persistent high blood pressure, it puts an extra strain on the arteries and heart, increasing the likelihood of a heart attack. Now, research had previously shown heart attacks survivors were more likely to adjust their behaviour if they were given programmes to guide them. And the latest analysis wanted to see if a partner contribution helped make those changes easier. So spouses were encouraged to attend the research sessions, and patients with a participating partner were almost three times more successful in losing weight compared to those who did it alone. So there was no more improvement in smoking cessation or physical activity when partners actively participated, however. So lifestyle improvement after a heart attack is a crucial part of preventing repeat events, and couples often have comparable lifestyles, and changing habits is difficult when only one person is making the effort. So if you want to lose weight, make sure that you've got your partner on board as well. That will be really good. Great. Well, I hope this week's show has given you some inspiration and learning all about the obesity crisis. And obviously, there's much more information out there as well. But it's a good idea if you are sort of tipping the wrong side of the scales, then it is a good idea to look at what you and your partner maybe might be able to do to lose some of those extra pounds. So I hope you found tonight's show interesting, helpful, inspiring to do something to improve your health. And until this time next week, take care of your body and take care of yourself.